Hi, my name is Harold Topper. Today is Friday, May 3rd, 2024. I'll be reading selected articles from today's editions of the Norwalk Hour, the Stanford Advocate, and the New York Times. Headline article, I-95 closure in Norwalk brings traffic delays for days as bridge demolition begins. A section of Interstate 95 remains closed as work began overnight to demolish the Fairfield Avenue overpass that was badly damaged after a fuel tanker erupted Thursday morning. Both sides of the highway between exits 14 and 16 are expected to remain closed until at least Monday morning, Governor Ned Lamont said Thursday. Closure caused massive delays on Thursday on the Merritt Parkway, Post Road, and other local streets in Norwalk, Westport, Darien, Stamford, and other surrounding towns as motorists tried to navigate the I-95 closure. Here's the latest on the I-95 closure and bridge demolition. Highway closure has caused wide-ranging traffic issues throughout southwestern Connecticut. The rows of cars backed up for miles along Interstate 95 Thursday and into Friday caused more than just an isolated traffic jam. With the major artery of I-95 shuttered in both directions, traffic appeared to also back up on the Merritt Parkway and local Norwalk roads on Friday morning. Thursday saw traffic issues spill into surrounding towns, Westport, Darien, and even Stamford, as drivers sought a way around the closure. The traffic chaos prompted Norwalk Public Schools to close on Friday, citing the, quote, ongoing traffic concerns and delays, end quote. The district said it would allow athletic games, drama performances, and proms to go forward, but all practices have been canceled through this weekend. State police said three drivers involved in Thursday's fiery crash that shuttered I-95 were men from Connecticut and New York who range in age from 22 to 42. The crash involved a 2010 Chevrolet Camaro LT, a Kenworth Construct T800 tanker carrying gasoline, and a Freightliner Cascadia 125 tractor trailer. All three vehicles were towed from the scene after the crash. None of the three drivers, quote, reported injuries while on scene, end quote, or was hospitalized, according to a summary of the crash state police released Friday morning. The 22-year-old driver of the Camaro is from Stamford and graduated from the University of Connecticut in December, having attended the school's Stamford campus, a university spokesperson confirmed. The two drivers of the commercial vehicles were identified as a 42-year-old man from Harrison, New York, who was driving the tanker, and a 35-year-old man from Bridgeport who was operating the other tractor trailer. Officials said the Fairfield Avenue Bridge will need to be replaced after the tanker ignited, causing a massive fire that spread across the highway under the bridge. Here's which roads are backed up as I-95 remains closed. Both sides of Interstate 95 remained closed Friday morning as crews began preparation work to demolish the Fairfield Avenue Bridge. The State Department of Transportation's traffic website showed congestion on both sides of the highway as of around 7 a.m. On the southbound side, all three lanes were backed up starting around exit 17 in Westport. The southbound lanes of I-95 are closed between exit 16 and 15. On the northbound side, traffic was slowed as far south as Keeler Avenue in Norwalk, the site showed. The northbound side of the highway is closed between exits 14 and 15. The closure is also resulting in delays for nearby roads as traffic is shuffled off the highway. Van Buren Avenue is backed up between Clinton Avenue and Maple Street, and the section of Fairfield Avenue that runs over I-95 where the fire occurred is closed from Cedar Street to the Post Road. None of the drivers in the crash were hospitalized, report says. Images of a Thursday morning's fiery crash on Interstate 95 showed flames stretching across the highway underneath Fairfield Avenue, leaving burned-out metal husks of the three vehicles involved after firefighters eventually put out the flames. Despite the harrowing scene, none of the three people involved were transported to the hospital, according to a summary of the crash released by state police. All three had, quote, no apparent injury, end quote, state police said. How authorities say the crash happened. The crash occurred around 5:30 a.m. Thursday morning between exits 14 and 15 and involved a fuel tanker, another tractor trailer, and a passenger vehicle, authorities said. The tanker swerved to avoid a collision after the passenger vehicle cut off a tractor trailer in the southbound lanes, officials said. The back of the tanker was ripped open, spilling its load of gasoline, which ignited. The resulting fire stretched across the highway underneath the Fairfield Avenue overpass, sending flames and a thick column of smoke into the morning sky. Work begins to demolish Fairfield Avenue overpass. Lamont said work was expected to begin at 3 a.m. Friday and last about 24 hours to replace the Fairfield Avenue bridge. Crews had begun working, but the demolition process had not yet started as of 5 a.m. In anticipation of traffic delays, Norwalk schools closed on Friday while Darien and Stanford had two-hour delays. The I-95 closure on Thursday caused significant traffic backups in towns along I-95 from Stanford to Westport, causing some students to be late for school, officials said. Moving now to a companion article. How a Norwalk company's, quote, green, end quote, foam-spraying vehicle helped put out fiery I-95 crash. Byline Catherine Lucci, Dateline Norwalk. With its foam-spraying vehicle, a local specialty chemical company answered Norwalk Fire Department's call for aid to help put out the massive fire caused by a tractor-trailer full of gasoline that was involved in a Thursday crash on Interstate 95. Retired Norwalk Fire Captain Tim Morissette received the call from his friend Ed McCabe, Assistant Chief Operations for Norwalk Fire Department, on his way to work at King Industries early Thursday morning. The vehicle is readily available for whenever it's needed, Morissette explained. Ed had given me a call, and I literally parked my vehicle and got in our quick response vehicle and headed to the highway. So under 5 minutes, we were able to get the vehicle on scene. King Industries worked alongside Norwalk Fire to contain the fire using their foam spraying technology. We also had to call in our partner from King Industries, which has a brand new foam-fighting vehicle, said Gino Gatto. Foam is the best way to put out this type of fire, he said. Robert King, Vice President of Operations at King Industries, explained many of their employees are either Norwalk firefighters or retired firefighters like Morissette. We train with the Norwalk Fire Department and the Fairfield County Hazmat Team throughout the year. So that serves for good camaraderie and mutual learning, King said. With a location just off the Norwalk River, the specialty chemical company produces and supplies lubricants, coatings, rubber, and specialty technology. For safety purposes, King Industries operates its own fire brigade, which is why the company had the vehicle ready to go. Once Morissette arrived with the foam spraying vehicle, he said Norwalk firefighters worked to get the foam distributed. Water supply is a problem, and especially on a highway like that, so it took us some time to get a good water supply so we could apply the correct amount of foam, Morissette said. Once we did get the water supply, probably 20 to 25 minutes, we were able to put the fire out with our vehicle. The fire erupted around 5:30 a.m. Thursday morning after a tractor-trailer carrying 8,500 gallons of gasoline crashed under the Fairfield Avenue overpass. Flames engulfed the bridge for about an hour until crews were able to extinguish them. Joe Coppola, Deputy Chief of Safety and Training for the Norwalk Fire Department, said King Industries was, quote, pivotal, end quote, in extinguishing the fire. Mike Burgoyne, King Industries Environmental Manager, said they use a, quote, green foam that does not contain, quote, forever chemicals, which are also known as PFAS. We use a green foam, which is non-fluorinated foam, Burgoyne said. Connecticut's Department of Energy and Environmental Protection was on site Thursday and confirmed the foam was environmentally friendly. I can assure the general public that everything that was used was the green foam, not PFAS, said Richard Swan from DEEP during the press conference. The runoff from the area was limited because of the amount of gasoline that consumed in the fire, and we have been able to contain into a retention pond behind the wall, and it did not make it to the Norwalk River at all, Swan said. King said the company values its relationship with Norwalk's fire department. I think it exemplifies the mutual benefits that result from a strong partnership between local government entities and private industry, King said. We just like being helpful in the community, and I think today was a good example of that. Moving now to the next article. Eversource's plan to put two transmission lines under Norwalk Harbor sparks concerns about docks. Byline Catherine Lucci, Dateline Norwalk. Plans for Eversource to place transmission lines under Norwalk Harbor as part of the $1 billion project to replace the Walk Train Bridge are prompting concerns over the future of the city's public docks. Eversource plans to place two existing overhead transmission lines underground by microtunneling from the Norwalk Police Station under the Norwalk River to East Norwalk on Fort Point Street, according to the project's webpage. However, the tunnel's path crosses in front of Norwalk's boat ramp off Veterans Memorial Park. Connecticut Department of Transportation is currently rebuilding the Walk Bridge that crosses the Norwalk River to ensure continued railroad operation along the vital Northeast Rail Corridor, Eversource's website says. As part of this work, we must relocate and energize the two electric transmission lines that span the top of the bridge. The tunnel's path through the river concerns the Norwalk Harbor Management Commission, which has petitioned the Connecticut Department of Energy and Environmental Protection to further investigate the project's impacts on the harbor and the future of the public dock. I think Eversource should be held responsible for any additional work that would be required, said John Pinto, a member of the Harbor Management Commission, during its March 27th meeting. If we had to replace or refurbish or redesign that dock in the future, having these two high-tension wires underneath our dock is going to set into motion an added expense. Microtunneling is a construction method in which a pit is dug to the desired depth, then sections of the tunnel are incrementally pushed into the earth horizontally, while the machine at the tip of the tube breaks up and evacuates the soil. Once complete, the tunnel will house 115 kilovolt transmission cables that power Norwalk. After gaining the necessary 25 signatures, the Harbor Management Commission has temporarily delayed the microtunneling project until DEEP hosts a site visit and hearing. During the last Harbor Commission meeting on April 24th, Chair Alan Kibbe said the visit is tentatively scheduled for May 22nd and the hearing tentatively for May 29th. Members of the Harbor Management Commission said the location of the electric cables will create a, quote, Pandora's box, end quote, of negative effects that could limit public access to the harbor. Completely replacing the dock would cost about $4 million, said Jeff Stedman during the meeting in April. Whether DEEP will deem the project a hindrance to public access and against the coastal management plan is unknown, but the commissioners remain skeptical. DEEP has recently announced their intent to approve Eversource's proposed method to relocate their two transmission lines from the Walk Bridge structure to conduits beneath the Norwalk River without conducting a public hearing, Commissioner Christopher White said on Facebook in asking for support for the petition. The Norwalk Harbor Management Commission believes it is important to have a public hearing on this proposal. Routing these transmission lines beneath the David Donovan Marine Center and the Norwalk River will create long-term impediments to maritime-related use and development in South Norwalk, he said. The Harbor Management Commission needs only 25 signatures to secure a public hearing, but the online petition was closed with 133 supporters. It's clear that there's no, in my opinion, there's not going to be any critical discussion, Stedman said. Initially, when we talked with Deep about it, they were interested in the effect on the visitor's dock because it's a permitted public access facility that's supported or encouraged by the Coastal Management Act. So there was some discussion that Deep might be able to protect the city's interest. Moving now to the Stanford Advocate and the front page article, Rico's Pizza Fends Off Eviction Attempt, byline Alexander Sewell. A pizzeria franchisor has fended off an eviction attempt in its home city of Stanford, with a Connecticut Superior Court judge describing a lengthy delay by a landlord in serving notice for additional amounts claimed on its lease as, quote, inexcusable, end quote. Rico's Pizza has Connecticut locations in Stanford, Darien, Norwalk, and Fairfield, as well as in New York, Massachusetts, and Florida. The chain has built a fan base for its, quote, bar-style, end quote, thin-crust pizza, including a hot oil variety. In a memorandum of decision, Judge John Cirillo took issue with building owner TPW Partners' delayed request for additional payments above base rent to cover water, city taxes, and other charges. Cirillo ruled Rico's, quote, was in substantial compliance with the lease agreement, end quote, and that an option it had exercised for a 5-year lease extension would remain in full force. Attorneys representing TPW Partners could not be reached immediately late Wednesday afternoon for any response to the court decision and whether the company would seek any appeal. Rico's has about 30 employees at its 886 Hope Street location, one of two in Stanford, along with a newer restaurant at 2010 West Main Street near the Greenwich Line. In his ruling, Cirillo cited the legal doctrine of laches, which allows a defendant to seek relief in instances when a plaintiff unreasonably delays asserting a claim to amounts owed. Basically, that's a legal defense for a claim that says, quote, if you snooze, you lose, end quote, said John Cassone, a partner in the Stanford law firm Crone & Cassone, which represented Rico's, in a Wednesday interview with Connecticut Insider. If you sit on your rights, you can lose your rights. And in this instance, what the court was saying was that the landlord never sent them an invoice for the additional rent. The base rent was paid punctually, Cassone added. Rico's, their business is run like a fine-tuned machine, and they pay their bills. In court, Rico's had testified it offered to pay half of the water costs for the building, which has apartments on the upper levels that shared the building's water meter. That offer was rejected by TPW Partners, which wanted Rico's to have all of the water costs and also city taxes, which Rico's had rejected on grounds taxes were never specified as a cost in its original lease. In court testimony in March, Rico's co-owner, Luigi Cardillo, said that TPW Partners had only a, quote, guesstimate, end quote, of actual water usage, having not taken meter recordings on a regular schedule. It doesn't spit out a ticket like the New York Stock Exchange, Cardillo said, according to a court transcription. It just rolls and rolls and rolls, depending on how many gallons of water it goes through. So if it's not red, you're not going to get any data. At the same hearing, TPW Partners managing member Prakash Wadhawani said his understanding of the lease was that, quote, responsibility resided with the tenant, with Rico's, end quote, in his words, to get adequate metering in place and keep records. Rico's demonstrated it had never missed a base rent payment from 2016 onward, including during the 2020 peak of the COVID-19 pandemic, when some commercial tenants sought delays or waivers from their landlords. In the March hearing, Cardillo said the company originally took the Hope Street space on a temporary basis to test a new pizza oven, then decided to take the space permanently when it became available. Cardillo said it cost at least $600,000 to renovate the space for Rico's, describing the process as, quote, a very difficult build-out, end quote, due to the prior condition of the building. "We totally changed the presence of the building on the street," Cardillo said, as quoted in the court transcript. "We made something that stood out. You know, when you drove by, you said, quote, 'Wow, what's that?'" End quote. Moving now to the next front page article. City residents oppose butter cannabis dispensary application. Byline Ignacio LaGuarda, Dateline Stanford. A marathon public hearing on a cannabis dispensary application on the West Side played out similarly to a recent one on a dispensary in the Cove neighborhood, with one major difference. When Air Wellness was before the zoning board on April 8th, representatives of Building One Community, including volunteers, clients, and members of the staff and board of directors, flooded the hearing in protest of the plan. AIR would have shared the same address as Building One Community if approved, and speakers argued it was an inappropriate location partly due to the number of children who used the facility for educational purposes. Community members have raised similar concerns with the location proposed for Butter Cannabis on the West Side because it is within 1,000 feet of the Yearwood Center, a community center that serves children in grades K through 3 with after school and summer camp, among other offerings. But when Butter was before the zoning board on Monday, no one from the Yearwood Center or Boys and Girls Club of Stanford, which runs programs at the center, spoke for or against the proposal. "I didn't hear anything from the Yearwood Center," said Joseph Capalbo, the attorney representing Butter, which is seeking a special permit to open at 389 West Main Street. "I didn't hear anything from the Boys and Girls Club." Craig Baker, CEO of the Boys and Girls Club of Stanford, could not immediately be reached for comment. Instead, most of the speakers in opposition Monday night were either neighbors to the proposed site or members of the Board of Representatives. They argued that the site was too close to the Yearwood Center and would bring unwanted traffic to the area. The zoning board's decision on Butter will likely hinge on whether or not members believe Yearwood indicated they plan to vote against AIR's application because they believed Building One Community fits the description of a school in the regulations. If they feel the same about Yearwood, members could vote to deny Butter's application as well. Capalbo argued that the definition of a school in the regulations does not apply to Yearwood and read the description out loud. Quote, "Any building, structure, and or land principally and regularly used by teachers and students for instructional or educational purposes," end quote. "It's not principally used as a school," Capalbo said. "It's a community center." He then read the regulations definition for a, quote, "public youth services agency," end quote, which is an organization that provides preschool to high school students with, quote, "facilities and programming for extracurricular education, recreation, and skill-building activities," end quote. "That is the definition of the Yearwood Center," he said. "That is the definition of the Boys and Girls Club." He claimed it would be illegal and arbitrary to deny Butter's application due to its proximity to the center. "I think you're stretching the definition of what a school is," he said. "Why? Because there's a stigma involved with this. That's all it is. Everybody's looking for a reason not to put it in my backyard." During the public hearing, those who spoke against the proposal outnumbered supporters 5-1. "This is going to be placed in a historically black neighborhood on the west side of Stanford and will be paraded in front of the children of this community," said Peter Thalheim, a member of the executive committee of the Stanford NAACP. "We are opposed to it." Butter Cannabis is a Connecticut company and is already in operation in West Hartford, Danbury, and Toland, with a fourth location in Stratford coming. "I like to say that our store is a sort of a combination between Whole Foods meets Starbucks, if you will," said Derek Gibbs, co-owner of Butter and former resident of Stanford. Many speakers urged Gibbs and co-owner Carl Torella Jr. to find a different location, but they said they searched for months for a spot that complied with the city's zoning regulations. "We looked at 23 different locations in Stanford," Torella said, adding that they searched for 7 to 8 months for a place to open. The reality of the situation is no location is going to be the quote-unquote right location, because everybody is going to have some opposition to a location, whether it be a school, traffic, or residence. Moving now to a related article. State could reclassify cannabis as a Schedule 3 drug. Byline Jordan Nathaniel Fenster. Federal authorities appear to be on the brink of reclassifying cannabis, a change which, if it happens, could affect the Connecticut cannabis market in a variety of ways. Ben Zaks, president of Fine Fettle, called the quote, "the news exciting," end quote. It's a landmark shift in what we've known for a long time, which is that to put cannabis on the same level as heroin and cocaine is an affront to every single person who's using this medicinally and recreationally, he said. It adds more legitimacy and hopefully continues to change the stigma around the cannabis plant and you know the people who use it. The Federal Drug Enforcement Agency has classified cannabis as Schedule 1 since 1970, listing it along with drugs like heroin and cocaine that the agency believes have no medical value. The DEA is poised to reclassify cannabis to Schedule 3, according to multiple unnamed sources who spoke to the Associated Press. There is no indication of when the shift may occur, and it would have to be approved by the White House Office of Management and Budget, though President Joe Biden has signaled his support. Criminal records for marijuana use and possession have imposed needless barriers to employment, housing, and educational opportunities, Biden said last year. Too many lives have been upended because of our failed approach to marijuana. It's time that we right these wrongs. Ben Pomerantz, a partner at Stanford's Carmody Law and head of the firm's cannabis group, said the shift could have far-reaching implications for research, taxes, pharmaceuticals, and banking. With large banking institutions concerned about its illegality, cannabis transactions have been limited to cash and debit. Pomerantz said that could now change. It will make it easier to operate these businesses as businesses, he said. This will make these companies easier to operate, but who knows what other hurdles we'll have to start to jump over. Cannabis would not be legalized, only reclassified, Pomerantz noted, which means some changes are as yet unknown. I don't want to make any comments at this point about interstate sales. George Archos, founder and CEO of Verano, one of the largest cannabis cultivators and retailers in the country, and owner of the Zen Leaf brand, said the move would mean, quote, "another significant domino has fallen in the fight to legalize cannabis and unlock its full potential as an industry," end quote. Connecticut attorney Alex Taubes, who is representing Joe Acidoludo and Cody Roberts, who have been accused of running illegal cannabis, quote, "gifting parties," end quote, said it could impact both civil and criminal cannabis cases. "The rescheduling of cannabis is long overdue and should be celebrated by everyone who believes in law and justice," Taubes said. "I am hopeful that with this broad reevaluation of the positive potential for cannabis and its therapeutic benefits, that all prisoners will be released and the repression of cannabis activists will end." Zaks said cannabis retailers would immediately be impacted by the tax implications of such a shift. At present, cannabis retailers may not deduct expenses, which Zaks said could change if cannabis is rescheduled. "That's a huge implication for us financially," he said. "You can't deduct any of your employees or your rent. You can't deduct basically anything, and this is a game changer for that." "Operationally, does it change the way we do anything? No. Does it change the check we need to write to the government? Substantially," he said. "Cannabis-related research will also be impacted. Researchers have found studying effects of cannabis and the chemical compounds it contains to be a challenge, considering the federal government's view that it has no benefit. People have been using cannabis for thousands of years, but yet the sort of documented empirical evidence to support what people are using it for has just been within the past few decades, said UConn professor Steve Kinsey. We're dealing with a Schedule 1 compound, which supposedly have no medical application, and yet now we have research showing that there are different applications for THC. Moving now to the New York Times and the headline article. Biden denounces campus violence breaking silence, backs lawful dissent. President rejects, quote, chaos, end quote, over war in Gaza as arrests increase. Byline Peter Baker, Dateline Washington. President Biden broke days of silence on Thursday to finally speak out on the wave of protests on American college campuses against Israel's war in Gaza that have inflamed much of the country, denouncing violence and anti-Semitism even as he defended the right to peaceful dissent. In a previously unscheduled televised statement from the White House, Mr. Biden offered a forceful condemnation of students and other protesters who, in his view, have taken their grievances too far. But he rejected Republican calls to deploy the National Guard to rein in the campuses. There's the right to protest, but not the right to cause chaos, Mr. Biden said in his first personal remarks on the campus fray in 10 days. People have the right to get an education, the right to get a degree, the right to walk across the campus safely without fear of being attacked. Anti-Semitism, he added, has no place in America. The president's comments came as universities across the nation continued to struggle to restore order. Police officers in riot gear arrested around 200 people as they cleared a protest encampment at the University of California, Los Angeles, while other officers removed demonstrators occupying a library at Portland State University in Oregon. Activists erected 30 tents at the University of Wisconsin-Madison a day after the police removed tents and detained 34 people. The confrontations on Thursday followed a tense 24 hours, during which police officers made arrests at Fordham University's Manhattan campus, the University of Texas at Dallas, Dartmouth College in New Hampshire, and Tulane University in New Orleans, among other places. As of Thursday, the campus unrest had led to nearly 2,000 arrests at dozens of academic institutions in the last 2 weeks, according to a New York Times tally. Administrators at some colleges, including Brown University in Rhode Island and Northwestern University in Illinois, opted to avoid conflict by striking deals with pro-Palestinian protesters to bring a peaceful end to their encampments. Agreements that have drawn harsh criticism from some Jewish leaders. The protests have erupted in response to Israel's war in Gaza since the October 7th Hamas-led terrorist attack killed 1,200 people in Israel and resulted in more than 200 taken hostage. More than 34,000 people in Gaza have been killed since then, according to authorities there, including both Hamas combatants and civilians. The protesters have demanded that the Biden administration cut off arms to Israel and that their schools divest from companies linked to Israel, but in many cases the demonstrations have included anti-Semitic rhetoric and harassment of Jewish students. Some of those sympathetic to the protesters pushed back against administrators for resorting to police action. The Columbia University chapter of the American Association of University Professors on Thursday called for the condemnation of Nemat Shafik, the university's president, after a police operation that removed students occupying Hamilton Hall and led to more than 100 arrests. Armed counterterrorism police on campus, student arrests, and harsh discipline were not the only path through this crisis, the group said. The images of arrests and clashes have come to dominate the political debate in Washington in recent days as Republicans seek to position themselves as defenders of Jewish students and portray Democrats and university leaders as soft on anti-Semitism. A day after the House passed a bipartisan measure seeking to codify a broader definition of anti-Semitism into federal education policy, with 70 Democrats and 21 Republicans voting no, a group of 20 Senate Republicans introduced its own version of the resolution. Anti-Semitism is rearing its ugly head at college campuses across our nation, said the bill's sponsor, Senator Tim Scott, Republican of South Carolina, and a possible vice presidential running mate for former President Donald J. Trump. Jewish students are being targeted with violence and harassment, and the university presidents and administrators who should be defending them are caving to the radical mob and allowing chaos to spread. Mr. Trump weighed in on social media. "This is a radical left revolution taking place in our country," he wrote in all capital letters as the confrontation at UCLA escalated. "Where is crooked Joe Biden? Where is Governor Newsom? The danger to our country is from the left, not from the right," end quote. Governor Gavin Newsom of California, a Democrat, issued his own statement on Wednesday. "The right to free speech does not extend to inciting violence, vandalism, or lawlessness on campus," he said. That was the formulation that Mr. Biden advanced during his televised comments on Thursday morning before leaving the White House for a day-long trip to North Carolina, where he met with relatives of four law enforcement officers killed in Charlotte on Monday, and later gave a speech in Wilmington announcing plans to replace lead pipes. "Destroying property is not a peaceful protest. It's against the law," the president said. "Vandalism, trespassing, breaking windows, shutting down campuses, forcing the cancellation of campuses, of classes and graduations, none of this is a peaceful protest. Threatening people, intimidating people, instilling fear in people is not peaceful protest. It's against the law. Dissent is essential to democracy, but dissent must never lead to disorder or to denying the rights of others so students can finish the semester and their college education." Mr. Biden has been pushing for an agreement between Israel and Hamas that would end the combat, at least temporarily, but a deal has remained elusive. Under a U.S.-sponsored proposal on the table, Israel would enter a ceasefire for 6 weeks and release hundreds of Palestinians held in its prisons, while Hamas would free 33 of the more than 100 hostages it is still holding. The president and his team hope that such a first stage will lead to a longer cessation of hostilities and the release of more hostages as well as more food, medicine, and other aid to ease the humanitarian crisis in Gaza. But American officials said that while Israel has agreed to the plan, Hamas has so far refused. The president's four-minute statement came after some Democrats pressed him to publicly address the campus uprisings. Until Thursday, Mr. Biden had offered only a couple of sentences in response to reporter questions on April 22nd that even Democrats considered too equivocal and otherwise left it to his spokespeople to express his views. Republicans have castigated him for not weighing in himself. Mr. Biden implied that his critics were simply being opportunistic. "In moments like this, there are always those who rush in to score political points," he said. "But this isn't a moment for politics. It's a moment for clarity. So let me be clear. Peaceful protest in America. Violent protest is not protected. Peaceful protest is." In calming some in his party, though, Mr. Biden took heat from others on the political left. In their view, he employed none of the nuance that he expressed in 2020 when otherwise peaceful protests after the police killing of George Floyd got out of control, and Mr. Biden acknowledged root causes of the anger even while condemning violence. "He could have made some effort to do the same today," said Matt Duss, a former foreign policy advisor to Senator Bernie Sanders, the Democratic Socialist from Vermont. Instead, he chose to amplify a right-wing caricature. "Unfortunately, it's consistent with an overall policy approach that shows little regard for Palestinian perspectives or Palestinian lives." In his statement, Mr. Biden emphasized that he would always defend free speech, even for those protesting his own support for Israel's war. But he made clear that he thought too many of the demonstrations had gone beyond the bounds of simple speech. "Let's be clear about this as well," he added. There should be no place on any campus, no place in America, for anti-Semitism or threats of violence against Jewish students. There is no place for hate speech or violence of any kind, whether it's anti-Semitism, Islamophobia, or discrimination against Arab Americans or Palestinian Americans. In response to questions by reporters, Mr. Biden said he would not change his Middle East policy as a result of the protests. Asked as he left the room if the National Guard should intervene, he said simply, no. Moving now to the business section in the New York Times. Fed is eyeing job market. It's murky. Byline Giannis Mialik. The Federal Reserve spent much of 2022 and 2023 narrowly focusing on inflation as policymakers set interest rates. Prices were rising way too fast, so they became the central bank's top priority. But now that inflation has cooled, officials are more clearly factoring the job market into their decisions again. One potential challenge? It's a very difficult moment to assess exactly what monthly labor market data are telling us. Jerome H. Powell, the Fed chair, said during a news conference on Wednesday that the way the job market shaped up in coming months could help to guide whether and when the central bank lowered interest rates this year. A substantial weakening could prod policymakers to cut, he suggested. If job growth remains rapid and inflation remains stuck, on the other hand, the combination could keep the Fed from lowering interest rates anytime soon. But it is tough to guess which of those scenarios may play out. And it is trickier than usual to determine how hot today's job market is, especially in real time. Fed officials will get the latest reading on Friday morning when the Labor Department releases its April employment report. Hiring has been rapid in recent months. That would typically make economists nervous that the economy was on the cusp of overheating. Businesses would risk competing for the same workers, pushing up wages in a way that could eventually drive up prices. But this hiring boom is different. It has come as a wave of immigrants and workers coming in from the labor market sidelines have helped to notably increase the supply of applicants. That has allowed companies to hire without depleting the labor pool. Yet, the jump in available workers has also meant that a primary measure that economists use in assessing the job market's strength, payroll gains, is no longer providing a clear signal. That leaves economists turning to other indicators to evaluate the strength of the job market and to forecast its forward momentum. And those measures are delivering different messages. Wage growth is still very strong by some gauges, but it seems to be cooling by others. Job openings have been coming down, the employment rate has ticked up recently, particularly for black workers, and hiring expectations in business surveys have wobbled. The takeaway is that this seems to be a strong job market, but exactly how strong is hard to know. It is even harder to guess how much oomph will remain in the months to come. If job gains were to slow, would that be a sign that the economy was beginning to buckle, or just evidence that employers have finally sated their demand for new hires? If job gains were to stay strong, would that be a sign that things were overheating, or evidence that labor supply was still expanding? Through a pre-pandemic lens, the economy looks quite strong, maybe even hot, said Ernie Tedeschi, a research scholar at Yale Law School who was, until this spring, a White House economic advisor. But given all of the gains to labor supply, quote, maybe we shouldn't use a pre-pandemic lens for thinking about the economy right now, end quote, he said. Friday's report is expected to show that job gains remained rapid in April. Economists are forecasting a 240,000-person jump in payrolls, according to a Bloomberg survey. That would continue the trend over the past year. The economy added 247,000 jobs per month on average from March 2023 to March 2024. To put that in context, the economy had added 167,000 jobs a month in the year through March 2019, the spring before the onset of the coronavirus pandemic. The Fed's policy committee voted this week to keep interest rates at 5.3%, where they have been set since July. Mr. Powell signaled that they are likely to stay at that relatively high level longer than previously expected, as officials await evidence that inflation is poised to cool further after months of stalled progress. But while the path ahead for price increases will be the main driver of policy, Mr. Powell said that, quote, as inflation has come down now to below 3%, end quote, employment also, quote, now comes back into focus, end quote. For now, Fed officials have not been overly worried about rapid drop gains. Mr. Powell noted on Wednesday that the economy had been able to grow more strongly in 2023, partly because the labor supply had expanded so much, both because of immigration and because more people were participating in the job market. Remember what we saw last year: very strong growth, a really tight labor market, and a historically fast decline in inflation, Mr. Powell said. I wouldn't rule out that something like that can continue. On the other hand, Mr. Powell hinted that Fed officials were keeping an eye on wage growth. He suggested repeatedly that strong wage increases alone would not be enough to drive the Fed's decisions. But the Fed chair still signaled that recent wage gains were stronger than the Fed thought would be consistent with low and stable inflation over time. As companies pay more to attract workers, many economists think that they are likely to raise prices to cover climbing labor costs and protect profit margins. Pay gains remain strong by key measures. Data this week showed that a measure of wages and benefits that the Fed watches closely, called the Employment Cost Index, climbed more rapidly than expected at the start of 2024. We don't target wage increases, but in the longer run, if you have wage increases running higher than productivity would warrant, there will be inflationary pressures, Mr. Powell said this week. When it comes to slowing down wage gains to a sustainable pace, quote, we have a ways to go on that, end quote. Whether job gains and wage gains will remain so rapid is unclear. Bill Casco, the president of a white-collar employment placement agency in Texas, said that while he continues to see strong demand for workers, he also noticed employers becoming pickier as the outlook for interest rates and the looming presidential election stoked uncertainty. They wanted to see more job candidates and take longer to make decisions. There's still demand, it's just not moving as quickly, Mr. Casco said. If employers start to pull back more concertedly, Mr. Powell made clear this week that a, quote, meaningful, end quote, jump in joblessness could prod the central bank to lower rates. He suggested that a, quote, meaningful, end quote, rise in unemployment could prod the central bank to lower rates. The upshot? It seems as if officials would be more alarmed by a marked job market slowdown than by strong continued payroll gains, especially when it is hard to tell whether robust hiring numbers signal that the labor market is hot or simply that it is changing. There's an asymmetry in how they view the labor market, said Michael Feroli, the chief economist at J.P. Morgan. Returning now to the Stanford Advocate. Man charged with sexual abuse rejects state's offer. Byline Pat Tomlinson, Dateline Stanford. A Stanford man accused of having sex with underage girls as part of an alleged sex trafficking operation rejected a state's offer of a shortened prison sentence in exchange for a guilty plea on Wednesday. Under the offer, Eugene Luini, 62, would have pleaded guilty to commercial sexual abuse of a minor, which is a Class B felony punishable by up to 20 years and risk of injury to a minor. In return for the guilty pleas, Luini would have received 6 years in prison and 5 years of probation, according to Assistant State's Attorney Margaret Muscati. If Luini violated that probation, he would have faced up to 4 more years in prison. After rejecting the state's offer, Luini requested a supervised judicial pretrial where a judge could offer a better disposition deal. The supervised hearing is scheduled for July 11th. Luini was arrested by Norwalk police in December 2022 alongside Teresa Martinez, a 38-year-old Bridgeport woman accused of prostituting the minors to Luini. Martinez and Luini have been under investigation by Norwalk Police's Special Services Division starting in January 2021 when the State Department of Children and Families received an anonymous tip regarding sex trafficking of juveniles in Norwalk, police said at the time of their arrest. At their arraignments, Muscati outlined how Martinez, also known as, quote, Tekka, end quote, had allegedly brought underage girls to have sex with Luini over the course of 2 months in 2020 in exchange for money. Norwalk Police Detective Patrick English wrote in the warrants that Martinez had connected Luini with at least three separate juveniles, ages 15, 16, and 17, between October and November 2020. In the warrant, the juveniles detail many different encounters with Luini at the former DoubleTree Hotel in Norwalk. The juveniles describe Luini, who was convicted in New York for first-degree rape of someone under 11 years old, first-degree sodomy, and soliciting a prostitute as, quote, really aggressive, end quote, and verbally abusive, according to the warrant. In her interview with police, Martinez allegedly told officers that she originally met Luini while working as a prostitute herself, her warrant said. But after meeting with him a couple of times, Luini allegedly began asking for a, quote, young girl, end quote, according to the warrant. English wrote that Martinez described bringing three separate juveniles to meet with Luini, though she claimed two never had sex with him and the other one never told her what happened in the hotel room. Martinez, who is also charged with soliciting sexual acts, risk of injury to a minor, and trafficking in persons, is scheduled to appear in court on June 26. Moving now to our From the Business section of the New York Times. Sony and Apollo express interest in striking deal for Paramount. Byline Benjamin Mullen and Lauren Hirsch. Sony Pictures Entertainment and the private equity giant Apollo Global Management have formally expressed interest in acquiring Paramount for roughly $26 billion, according to two people familiar with the matter, a move that adds drama to an already chaotic deal-making process. The non-binding expression of interest, sent in a letter this week, comes as Paramount approaches an agreed-upon Friday deadline for the expiration of an exclusive negotiating period with Skydance, a Hollywood studio run by the tech scion David Ellison. Paramount has been in talks with Skydance for months, discussing a complicated transaction that would involve a merger and an investment from the private equity firm Redbird Capital Partners. The new joint expression of interest would make Sony a significant majority and controlling shareholder and Apollo a minority shareholder. The proposed all-cash acquisition may appeal to Paramount shareholders who have come out against the Skydance deal over concerns it benefits the company's controlling shareholder, Shari Redstone, at the expense of others. Paramount declined to comment. The proposed merger of Sony and Paramount would create a new powerhouse in Hollywood, uniting the studios behind the, quote, Spider-Man, end quote, and, quote, Mission Impossible, end quote, franchises. Sony executives have discussed operating the Paramount studio as a division of their broader empire, combining their marketing and distribution functions. Sony, a sprawling international conglomerate known for its cutting-edge electronics business, is an unconventional suitor for Paramount. Like Comcast, which owns NBC Universal, Sony has a highly profitable business outside traditional media, generating hundreds of millions of dollars from video games, music, imaging, and sensors. That insulates Sony from the travails of the media industry, which has lately been challenged by the decline of the traditional theatrical business and the death of cable television. The letter, which was signed by Tony Vincenzo, the chief executive of Sony Pictures Entertainment, and Aaron Sobel, a partner at Apollo, is intended to be a starting point for negotiations to acquire the company, according to a person familiar with the matter. The two sides have not begun doing due diligence, a process that could affect the amount Sony and Apollo are willing to pay. One looming question for both Apollo and Sony is the eventual fate of Paramount's CBS broadcast network. Regulations restrict foreign ownership of broadcast networks, throwing up a potential roadblock for Sony Pictures, a division of the Tokyo-based Sony Group Corporation. But the companies believe they can overcome those concerns, according to two people familiar with their plans. Apollo, a U.S.-based firm, already owns the TV station group Cox Media Group, a deal that required approval from the Federal Communications Commission, which regulates U.S. broadcasters. The FCC, however, blocked a separate deal that involved Apollo when the investment firm Standard General tried to buy Tegna, a TV station group, with financing from Apollo. One possible remedy under consideration is to have Apollo, which has already gone through government approval, hold the license for the CBS broadcast network, the people said. It remains to be seen whether a bid from Sony and Apollo would be acceptable to Ms. Redstone, whose controlling stake would allow her to veto any deal. Ms. Redstone has already signed off on a potential deal to sell her controlling stake to Skydance, but that deal is contingent on a separate deal for Paramount. Moving now to our final article of the day from the Norwalk Hour. Minx to Sinks sale returns to White Tents in Wilton benefits Norwalk's Family and Children's Agency. Byline Karen Tensa, Dateline Wilton. When it comes to bargain hunting in Wilton, this is one of the two best weekends of the year. That's because twice a year, the Minx to Sink sale is held under massive white tents set up at 395 Danbury Road at the corner of School Road and Route 7 near the Wilton High School tennis courts. The giant tag sale, which is held each spring and fall, is a fundraiser that benefits the Norwalk-based Family and Children's Agency. It began in 1931 and is a largely volunteer-run event. For days, volunteers accepted donations and consigned items that will be placed up for sale. Shoppers can enjoy buying unique items at competitive prices while also supporting the crucial human services provided by Family and Children's Agency. The many donated items for sale include toys, clothing, furniture, lamps, housewares, rugs, bicycles, lawnmowers, and more, and presumably even a few minks and sinks. The sale will be held Saturday from 9 a.m. to 5 p.m., Sunday from noon to 4 p.m. with everything half off, and Monday from 9 to 11 a.m. when shoppers can fill a bag for $10. Family and Children's Agency, a nonprofit human services organization, provides behavioral and mental health services, addiction recovery services, after-school programs, parenting counseling, housing and homelessness services, family counseling, foster care training, senior services, and more to area residents of all ages. For more information, visit www.familyandchildrensagency.org. Again, that's for more information, visit www.familyandchildrensagency.org. Well, that's all the time we have today. It's Friday, May 3rd, 2024. My name's Harold Topper, and I've been reading selected articles from today's editions of the New York Times, the Norwalk Hour, and the Stanford Advocate. Please stay safe.